Chapter 12. Spec Ops 27. The Literary Detectives. This morning, Thursday Next joined the Literatech office in place of Cromarty. I cannot help thinking that she is particularly unsuited to this area of work, and I have my doubts as to whether she is as sane as she thinks she is. She has many demons, old and new, and I wonder whether Swindon is quite the right place to try and exorcise them. From Bowden Cable's diary. The Swindon Spec Ops headquarters were shared with the local police. The typically brusque and no-nonsense Germanic design had been built during the occupation as a law court. It was big, too, which was just as well. The way into the building was protected by metal detectors, and once I had shown my ID, I walked into the large entrance hall. Officers and civilians with identity tags walked briskly amid the loud hubbub of the station. I was jostled once or twice in the throng and made a few greetings to old faces before fighting my way to the front desk. When I got there, I found a man in a white baggy shirt and breeches remonstrating with the sergeant. The officer just stared at him. He'd heard it all before.
"Name?" asked the desk sergeant wearily.
"John Milton."
"Which John Milton?"
John Milton sighed.
496.
The sergeant made a note in his book.
"How much did they take?"
200 in cash and all my credit cards.
"Have you notified your bank?"
"Of course."
"And you think your assailant was a Percy Shelley?"
"Yes," replied the Milton. "He handed me this pamphlet on rejecting current religious dogma before he ran off."
"Hello, Ross," I said. The sergeant looked at me, paused for a moment, and then broke into a huge grin.
"Thursday! They told me you'd be coming back. Told me you'd made it all the way to SO5, too."
I returned his smile. Ross had been the desk sergeant when I had first joined the Swindon police.
"What are you doing here?"
he asked.
"Starting up a regional office. SO9 or something. Add a touch of spice to tired old Swindon."
"Not exactly. I've transferred into the Literatech office." A look of doubt crossed Ross's face, but he quickly hid it.
"Great!"
he enthused, slightly uneasily.
"Drink later?"
I agreed happily, and after getting directions to the Literatech office, left Ross arguing with Milton 496. I took the winding stair to the upper floor and then followed directions to the far end of the building. The entire West Wing was filled with Spec Ops or their regional departments. The Environmental Spec Ops had an office here, as did Art Theft and the Chrono Guard. Even Spike had an office up here, although he was rarely seen in it. He preferred a dark and rather fetid lock-up in the basement car park. The corridor was packed with bookcases and filing cabinets. The old carpet had almost worn through in the centre. It was a far cry from the Literatech office in London, where we had enjoyed the most up-to-date information retrieval systems. At length, I reached the correct door and knocked. I didn't receive an answer, so I walked straight in. The room was like a library from a country home somewhere. It was two stories high, with shelves crammed full of books covering every square inch of wall space. A spiral staircase led to a catwalk which ran around the wall, enabling access to the upper shelves. The middle of the room was open plan, with desks laid out much like a library's reading room. Every possible surface and all the floor space were piled high with more books and papers, and I wondered how they managed to get anything done at all. About 5 officers were at work, but they didn't seem to notice me come in. A phone rang, and a young man picked it up.
"Literatech office,"
he said in a polite voice. He winced as a tirade came down the phone line to him.
"I'm very sorry if you didn't like Titus Andronicus, madam," he said at last, "but I'm afraid it's got nothing to do with us. Perhaps you should stick to the comedies in future."
I could see Victor and Allergy looking through a file with another officer.
I walked to where he could see me and waited for him to finish.
Ah, next. Welcome to the office. Give me a moment, will you?
I nodded, and Victor carried on.
I think Keats would have used less flowery prose than this, and the third stanza is slightly clumsy in its construction. My feeling is that it's a clever fake, but check it against the verse meter analyzer.
The officer nodded and walked off. Victor smiled at me and shook my hand.
That was Finisterre. He looks after poetry forgery of the 19th century. Let me show you around.
He waved a hand in the direction of the bookshelves.
Words are like leaves, Thursday.
Like people, really. Fond of their own society. He smiled.
We have over 1 billion words here. Reference, mainly. A good collection of major works and some minor ones that you won't even find in the Bodleian. We've got a storage facility in the basement. That's full as well. We need new premises, but the Literatechs are a bit underfunded, to say the least.
He led me around one of the desks to where Bowden was sitting bolt upright, his jacket carefully folded across the back of his chair, and his desk so neat as to be positively obscene.
Bowden, you've met. Fine fellow. He's been with us for 12 years and concentrates on 19th-century prose. He'll be showing you the ropes. That's your desk over there.
He paused for a moment, staring at the cleared desk. I was not supernumerary. One of their number had died recently, and I was replacing him, filling a dead man's shoes, sitting in a dead man's chair. Beyond the desk sat another officer, who was looking at me curiously.
That's Fisher. He'll help you out with anything you want to know about legal copyright and contemporary fiction.
Fisher was a stocky man with an odd squint, who appeared to be wider than he was tall. He looked up at me and grinned, revealing something left over from breakfast stuck between his teeth. Victor carried on walking to the next desk.
17th and 18th century prose and poetry are looked after by Helmut Beit, kindly lent to us by our opposite number across the water. He came here to sort out a problem with some poorly translated Goethe and became embroiled with a neo-Nazi movement attempting to set Friedrich Nietzsche up as a fascist saint.
Herr Beit was about 50 and looked at me suspiciously. He wore a suit but had removed his tie in the heat.
"'SO5, eh?' asked Herr Beit, as though it were a form of venereal disease.
"'I'm SO27, just like you,' I replied quite truthfully. 8 years in the London office under Boswell.' Beit picked up an ancient-looking volume in a faded pigskin binding and passed it across to me.
"'What do you make of this?'
I took the dusty tome in my hand and looked at the spine. "'The Vanity of Human Wishes,' I read, "'written by Samuel Johnson and published in 1749, "'the first work to appear in his own name. "'I opened the book and flicked through the yellowed pages. "'First edition. "'It would be very valuable
if,' repeated Beit.
"'I sniffed the paper and ran a finger across the page "'and then tasted it. I looked along the spine and tapped the cover, finally dropping the heavy volume on the desk with a thump. If it were real.
I'm impressed, Miss Next, admitted Herr Beit. You and I must discuss Johnson sometime.
It wasn't as difficult as it looked, I had to admit. Back in London, we've got 2 pallet loads of forged Johnsonia like this, with a street value of over £300,000.
"'London, too?'
exclaimed Beit in surprise.
"'We've been after this gang for 6 months. "'We thought they were local.
"'Call Boswell at the London office. "'He'll help in any way he can. "'Just mention my name.' "'Herr Beit picked up the phone and asked the operator for a number. "'Victor guided me over to one of the many frosted glass doors "'leading off the main chamber into side offices.' He opened the door a crack to reveal 2 officers in shirt sleeves who were interviewing a man dressed in tights and an embroidered jacket. Malin and Soule look after all crimes regarding Shakespeare.
He shut the door.
They keep an eye on forgery, illegal dealing, and overtly free thespian interpretations. The actor in with them was Graham Huxtable. He was putting on a felonious one-man performance of Twelfth Night. Persistent offender. He'll be fined and bound over. His Malvolio is truly frightful.
He opened the door to another side office. A pair of identical twins were operating a large computing engine. The room was uncomfortably hot from the thousands of valves, and the clicking of relays was almost deafening. This was the only piece of modern technology that I had seen so far in the office.
These are the 40 brothers, Jeff and Jeff. The 40s operate the verse meter analyzer. It breaks down any prose or poem into its components, words, punctuation, grammar, and so forth, then compares that literary signature with a specimen of the target writer in its own memory. 89% accuracy. Very useful for spotting forgeries. We had what purported to be a page of an early draft of Antony and Cleopatra. It was rejected on the grounds that it had too many verbs per unit paragraph.
He closed the door.
That's all of us. The man in overall charge of Swindon Spec Ops is Commander Braxton Hicks. He's answerable to the regional commander based in Salisbury. He leaves us alone most of the time, which is the way we like it.
He also likes to see any new operatives the morning they arrive, so I suggest you go and have a word. He's in room 28 down the corridor. We retraced our steps back to my desk. Victor wished me well again, and then disappeared to consult with Helmut about some pirate copies of Dr. Faustus that had appeared on the market, with the endings rewritten to be happy. I sat down in my chair and opened the desk drawer. There was nothing in it, not so much as a pencil shaving. Bowden was watching me. Victor emptied it the morning after Cromarty's murder. "James Cromarty," I murmured. "Suppose you tell me about him." Bowden picked up a pencil and tried to balance it on its sharp end. "Cromarty worked mainly in 19th century prose and poetry. He was an excellent officer, but excitable. He had little time for procedure. He vanished one evening when he said he had a tip-off about a rare manuscript. We found him a week later in the abandoned Raven public house on Morgue Road. They had shot him 6 times in the face. I'm sorry to hear that." "I've lost friends before," said Bowden, his voice never wavering from the measured pace of speech he used. "But he was a close friend and colleague, and I would gladly have taken his place." He rubbed his nose slightly. It was the only sign of outward emotion that he had shown. "I consider myself a spiritual man, Miss Next, although I'm not religious. By spiritual, I merely mean that I feel I have good in my soul, and am inclined to follow the correct course of action given a prescribed set of circumstances. Do you understand?" I nodded. "Having said that, I would still be very keen to end the life of the person who did this foul deed. I have been practicing on the range, and now carry a pistol full time. Look. Show me later, Mr. Cable. Do you have any leads?" "None. Nothing at all. We don't know who he was seeing or why. I have contacts over at Homicide. They have nothing either." "Being shot 6 times in the face is the mark of a person with a gleeful passion for the undertaking of their duties," I told him. "Even if Cromarty had been carrying a gun, I don't think it would have made much difference." "You could be right," sighed Bowden. "I can't think of a single time that a pistol has been drawn on a Literatech investigation." I agreed. 10 years ago in London it had been the same. But big business and the huge amounts of cash in the sale and distribution of literary works had attracted a bigger criminal element. I knew of at least 4 London Literatechs who had died in the line of duty. "It's becoming more violent out there. It's not like it is in the movies. Did you hear about the surrealist riot in Chichester last night?
I certainly did, he replied. I can see Swindon involved in similar disturbances before too long. The Art College nearly had a riot on its hands last year when the governors dismissed a lecturer who had been secretly encouraging students to embrace abstract expressionism. They wanted him charged under the Interpretation of the Visual Medium Act. He fled to Russia, I think.
I looked at my watch. I have to go and see the Special Ops Commander.
Bowden allowed a rare smile to creep upon his serious features.
I bid you good luck. If you would permit me to offer you some advice, keep your automatic out of sight. Despite James's untimely death, Commander Hicks doesn't want to see the Literatechs permanently armed. He believes that our place is firmly at a desk.
I thanked him, left my automatic in the desk drawer, and walked down the corridor. I knocked twice and was invited into the outer office by a young clerk. I told him my name, and he asked me to wait.
The commander won't be long.
Fancy a cup of coffee?
No, thanks.
The clerk looked at me curiously.
They say you've come from London to avenge Jim Cromarty's death. They say you killed two men. They say your father's face can stop a clock. Is this true?
It depends on how you look at it.
Office rumours are pretty quick to get started, aren't they?
Braxton Hicks opened the door to his office and beckoned me in. He was a tall, thin man, with a large moustache and a grey complexion. He had bags under his eyes. It didn't look as though he slept much. The room was far more austere than any commander's office I had ever seen. Several golf bags were leaning against the wall, and I could see that a carpet putter had been hastily pushed to one side. He smiled genially and offered me a seat before sitting himself.
Cigarette?
I don't, thank you.
Neither do I.
He stared at me for a moment and drummed his long fingers on the immaculately clear desk. He opened a folder in front of him and read in silence for a moment. He was reading my SO5 file. Obviously he and Analogy didn't get on well enough to swap information between clearances.
Operative Thursday next, eh?
His eyes flicked across the pertinent points of my career.
Quite a record. Police, Crimea, rejoined the police, then moved to London in 75. Why was that?
Advancement, sir. Braxton Hicks grunted and continued reading.
Special Ops for 8 years, twice commended. Recently loaned to SO5. Your stay with the latter has been heavily censored, yet it says here you were wounded in action.
He looked over his spectacles at me.
Did you return fire?
No.
Good.
I fired first.
Not so good.
Braxton stroked his moustache thoughtfully.
You were operative grade one in the London office working on Shakespeare, no less. Very prestigious. Yet you swap that for a grade three operative assignment in a backwater like this. Why?
Times change, and we change with them, sir. Braxton grunted and closed the file.
Here at Special Ops, my responsibility is not only with the Literatechs, but also art theft, vampirism and lycanthropy, the Chronogard, anti-terrorism, civil order and the dog pound. Do you play golf?
No, sir.
Shame, shame. Where was I? Oh, yes. Out of all those departments, do you know which I fear most?
I've no idea, sir.
I'll tell you. None of them. The thing I fear most is Special Ops regional budget meetings. Do you realise what that means next?
No, sir.
It means that every time one of you puts in for extra overtime or a special request, I go over budget, and it makes my head hurt right here.
He pointed to his left temple.
And I don't like that. Do you understand?
Yes, sir.
He picked up my file again and waved it at me.
I heard you had a spot of bother in the big city. Other operatives getting killed. It's a whole new different alternative kettle of fish here, you know. We crunch data for a living. If you want to arrest someone, then have uniform do it. No running about shooting up bad guys, no overtime, and definitely no 24-hour surveillance operations. Understand?
Yes, sir.
Now, about Hades.
My heart leaped. I had thought that would have been censored, if anything.
I understand. You think he is still alive?
I thought for a moment. My eyes flicked to the vial Hicks was holding. He divined my thoughts.
Oh, that's not in here, my dear girl. I may be a Hick commander in the boonies, but I do have my sources. You think he is still alive?
I knew I could trust Victor and Bowden, but about Hicks I was not so sure. I didn't think I would risk it. A symptom of stress, sir. Hades is dead. He plonked my file in the out tray, leaned back in his chair, and stroked his moustache, something he obviously enjoyed.
So you're not here to try and find him?
Why would Hades be in Swindon if he were alive, sir? Braxton looked uneasy for a moment.
Quite, quite.
He smiled and stood up, indicating that the interview was at an end.
Good. Well, run along. One piece of advice. Learn to play golf. You'll find it a very rewarding and relaxing game. This is a copy of the department's budget account, and this is a list of all the local golf courses. Study them well. Good luck.
I went out and closed the door after me. The clerk looked up.
Did he mention the budget?
I don't think he mentioned anything else. Do you have a waste bin? The clerk smiled and pushed it out with his foot. I dumped the heavy document in it unceremoniously.
Bravo,
he said. As I was about to open the door to leave, a short man in a blue suit came powering through without looking. He was reading a fax and knocked against me as he went straight through to Braxton's office without a word. The clerk was watching me for my reaction.
Well, well, I murmured. Jack Shit.
You know him?
Not socially.
As much charm as an open grave,
said the clerk, who had obviously warmed to me since I binned the budget. Steer clear of him. Goliath, you know. I looked at the closed door to Braxton's office. What's he here for? The secretary shrugged, gave me a conspiratorial wink, and said very pointedly and slowly,
I'll get that coffee you wanted, and it was 2 sugars, wasn't it?
No, thanks, not for me. No, no, he replied.
2 sugars. 2 sugars.
He was pointing at the intercom on the desk.
Heavens above, he exploded. Do I have to spell it out?
The penny dropped. The clerk gave a wan smile and scurried out of the door. I quickly sat down, flipped up the lever marked 2 on the intercom, and leaned closer to listen.
I don't like it when you don't knock, Mr. Shit.
I'm devastated, Braxton. Does she know anything about Hades?
She says not.
She's lying. She's here for a purpose. If I find Hades first, we can get rid of her.
Less of the we, Jack, said Braxton testily. Please remember that I have given Goliath my full cooperation, but you are working under my jurisdiction and have only the powers that I bestow upon you, powers that I can revoke at any time. We do this my way or not at all. Do you understand?
Shit was unperturbed. He replied in a condescending manner.
Of course, Braxton. As long as you understand that if this thing blows up in your face, the Goliath Corporation will hold you personally responsible. I sat down at my empty desk again. There seemed to be a lot going on in the office that I wasn't part of. Bowden laid his hand on my shoulder and made me jump.
I'm sorry. I didn't wish to startle you. Did you get the commander's budget speech?
And more. Jack Shit went into his office as though he owned the place.
Bowden shrugged. Since he's Goliath, then the chances are he does.
Bowden picked his jacket up from the back of his chair and folded it neatly across his arm.
Where are we going?
I asked.
Lunch. Then a lead in the Chuzzlewit theft. I'll explain on the way. Do you have a car?
Bowden wasn't too impressed when he saw the multicoloured Porsche.
This is hardly what one might refer to as low profile.
On the contrary, I replied. Who would have thought a literatech would drive a car like this? Besides, I have to drive it. He got in the passenger seat and looked around slightly disdainfully at the Spartan interior.
Is there a problem, Miss Next? You're staring.
Now that Bowden was in the passenger seat, I had suddenly realized where I had seen him before. He had been the passenger when the car had appeared in front of me at the hospital. Events had indeed started to fall into place.